From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, when everything you think you know about the Thanksgiving meal is wrong, food historian Kyle Cherrick joins us with a menu from that first feast in 1621. Then, while acid reflux is generally just a mild annoyance, for some people it can be a serious issue.
It's one of those things that's so common that people kind of blow it off to a certain extent, but when you're suffering from it and there's no getting away from it, it really does kind of become an all-consuming issue for people.
SAS Joanne Nelson thinks about the meaning of the food in our refrigerators, and Fit for You learns about muscle activation technique.
I had been a physical therapist for about 10 years, and I was frustrated by the lack of progress that I felt like I was making with my clients. I felt like the treating the tightness, digging in on these tight muscles, trying to stretch these tight muscles, it really wasn't getting to the root of things.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. It is the day before Thanksgiving, and we all know what that means. Tomorrow, most of us will eat way more than our fair share of turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce. Mm-mm. It is the all-American thing to do with this most all-American of meals. But food historian Kyle Cherrick says if we think we're eating a true representation of the first Thanksgiving feast of 1621, well, we'd be wrong. And that was not exactly music to our ears or tummies, so of course we asked him to come in to explain himself. Kyle Cherrick, hey.
Hey, Bonnie.
It is so great to see you.
It's good to see you. Happy Thanksgiving soon.
Happy Thanksgiving tomorrow,
yeah.
Actually. And, you know, I am so, it's my favorite time. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite holiday. It was my mother's favorite holiday. I love the Thanksgiving meal. I love the turkey and the dressing and the and the cranberry sauce and the mashed potatoes and the squash. Are you looking forward to it too?
It's my favorite holiday for a couple of reasons. One, it's a big food holiday. It's the biggest food holiday.
Yeah.
But it's everyone's holiday. If you are an American, there's no exclusionary aspect to this holiday. It's where we celebrate the deliciousness of what it means to be an American. And you can cook a Thanksgiving meal. Yes, there's certain classic tenets, but you can cook a Thanksgiving meal with some improvisations, and that's open to everybody, too.
So, well, everyone has their special thing, their aunt's special pudding, or, yeah, you know, their grandmother's
the green bean
stuffing,
casserole.
The green bean casserole and everything. But, you know, I have to say, I am going to pick a bone with you.
Okay. Is it going to be a wishbone?
Of course it is.
Yes.
Of course it is. Well, maybe it's not, because I think what you're going to tell me is that all of these things that I love aren't really Thanksgiving, or at least they weren't the original.
They're not legit.
Oh,
they're
no!
not legit. No,
no, no, no. no. You've just burst my bubble.
Yeah, I mean, it. Culinary historians every year, we get online and we go back and forth in social media, and we're sort of like, ah, this is. Well, put it this way: this is the first year that instead of Columbus Day, we celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day. So, in honor of that authenticity and honesty in our national celebrations, I think we should sort of note what the first Thanksgiving feast was like. 1621, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, whatever you want to call them, they're not the first Americans. We'd had people here before. We'd had people here long before up in Newfoundland harvesting and salting cod and shipping it back to England and all the way down to Jamaica and creating that.
I was going to say, and the indigenous people who were here were 12,000 years.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying, thanks for the smallpox. Here's some venison.
Yeah.
But that first meal where they did make some peace with the natives, certainly. They were in a very good space for the most part. But it was really a big seafood fest. That's what was available. Hogshead eels, lobster in abundance, mussels, oysters, and I know you're a New Englander, and so oysters in the stuffing is a bit of an homage to that, mm-hmm. though stuffing as we think of it now didn't exist because there weren't grains and bread per se. They had flint corn, which they called Indian corn, and the good old Puritans, folks of God, had actually stolen the corn seed the summer before. And planted their own, but they had been working with the native peoples and learned how to raise it, so they did have comparatively, an abundance of corn.
And was that corn able to be ground into flour?
No, not into flour. More of a mush.
Okay.
More of a porridge, which being, well, not quite Great Britainers yet, but Englanders, they knew mush. They knew porridge. This was a sustaining thing. And very similar in some ways to the original breads that, say, the Egyptians, or the slaves that the Egyptians baked for when they built the pyramids. It would have been unleavened and combined with some water and sort of shaped into a form and then put into an oven and baked.
Hardtack.
Yeah, hardtack. Not quite. You'd have a chewy center because that's okay. How flint cord. I've had historic reenactments of flint cord bread. So it's not the kind of crumb that we have from a great baguette, but it's not hardtack either. So there would be no stuffing. We have epistolary knowledge. I love to go back to historical knowledge of a fellow by the name of Winslow who wrote a letter in December describing this meal. And the governor sent out four men to get waterfowl, which was abundant. Think of where they were.
Okay, ducks.
Ducks,
geese
exactly, mm-hmm. That sort of thing. So they came back with lots of that. The native tribe that came gifted five deer to the governor. This was kind of a lovely holiday peace offering and whatever auspices that they had it. So we know there was lots of venison and there was lots of seafood.
So were the natives harvesting the seafood and teaching the pilgrims how to do that?
Yes and no.
Okay.
The lobster were so abundant that they could just go out and get them. The eels, a little harder to trap, and the natives had constructed wooden traps. Mussels and oysters, I mean, you know.
You just pick them.
Yeah, it is what it is. And that was something that was known to these English folks on how to, I mean, oysters are so simple. You know, you just put them into a fire, essentially, and cook them that way. They're still delicious, and we still have oyster or clam bakes within that experience. And oysters are, just a little sidebar, oysters are really an interesting story in American food because they were eaten at the first, quote-unquote, Thanksgiving meal, but they were also an access to income by free or freed African Americans as we go into the 18th century. They were sold roadside, and it was a way to, I mean, there it was. If you went and harvested, then you could create a little braiser and cook them yourselves, which created an American appetite for the oyster bar sell them raw, that kind of thing. And there's so many things within, it's another talk, right? But within our national appetite that have come from African-American either chutzpah and creating a, you know, job for themselves or just great culinary traditions that work their way in through. I mean, the word yum is a Senegalese word that came over with enslaved people here, and it's basically slightly misheard or repronounced into yum yum. So
That's
part of our history, and we can't avoid that either.
No, and nor should we.
Nor should we. So you would have had the seafood, you would have had the venison, you would have had wild plums, which, and this is all in the letter, similar to something called damson, which are indigenous to Great Britain. You would have had gooseberries and grapes, red and white. He lists out grapes. So when we bedeck our Thanksgiving dinner table with this huge turkey, which, as we've talked about, you know, the great irony of the turkey is that when the Spanish first came over and they found the turkey in Mesoamerica and they grabbed it and they took it back to Spain and they had turkey farms within 15, 20 years, then it made its way through Europe. I just love this story. So the first Thanksgiving dinner is 1621. In 1629, another bunch of Brits landing in Virginia brought turkeys with them.
So the turkey makes a huge big circle back.
Yeah.
But it's, of course, a different turkey at that point.
It is a different turkey at that point. Yeah, there are two original species, essentially, a northern and a southern, to make things much more simple. And the turkey that we have is a hybrid of lots of these heritage breeds. But and lots of genetic engineering, get over it, everybody, to a certain extent, there always has been. We wouldn't have, you know, certain yummy vegetables if we didn't have that along the way. So that's the first Thanksgiving feast, but I want to talk about a couple of other things through history that came around, like stuffing. We don't have that appear in an American cookbook until 1792 with Arnelia Simmons' American Cookery of 1792. She describes a very simple stuffing, and this is not one that is spiked with sage and butter and salt and all the, you know, pecans.
Onions.
This is scraps of bread that are cooked up, and it basically, take your parsnips, your onions, your ramps, your whatever you've got, and put that in there. But it's really thought of more of a cavity perfuming aspect than something that people would fight over or say, you got to make, you know,
so-and-so's. Extra stuffing.
Yeah.
Extra, yeah.
Yeah. So-and-so's again. Cranberries. Cranberries were possibly, and I love this story, possibly part of the first Thanksgiving meal.
But I was going to ask about that because I know the cranberry bogs in Massachusetts are famous.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and they were. I mean, Martha's Vineyard was essentially like
a cranberry bog.
Yeah, ground zero for cranberry bogs, exactly, which is not too far away from where this first meal happened. If it was there, and this is we don't know. We know at the time the native peoples were making something that was called Sabaheg stew, which is cranberries, beans, corn, clams, clam juice, and you know, whatever else you can put in there. I mean, to a certain extent, whatever you've got seasonally that you can put in. You cook it down. It's got lots of phytonutrients and antioxidants and all kinds of great
actually
sustaining things.
Actually sounds kind
of good. That I haven't had a reinterpretation of because, of course, it's not like they had measurements, you know, and it was probably different every time based on what you could get. And then green sauce, there was no gravy per se, but we do know also that the native peoples would make something called a green sauce, which was really just spinach and collard if that was available and ramps and onions and, you know, turnips and whatever could be foraged and then cooked down. And this was something that was eaten and served along with venison. We know this by the native peoples in the area.
Now, that's really interesting because I know there's probably no direct connection to this, but when I was in Paris last, I had a home-cooked meal that it was fish, but the sauce on the fish, and you know the French are famous for their sauces.
Yeah, yeah.
It was made of turnip.
Really?
It was a turnip sauce, and it was one of the most delicious things and unexpected things.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to you saying, and so, you know, the native peoples here were already doing that.
Yeah. I mean, so they wouldn't have had lard or butter the way that the French use.
Would do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's sort of the three regions of French cooking where it's either lard, olive oil, or butter, and that you could travel the country and dissect it that way. They wouldn't have had those things.
But they would have had animal fat of some kind.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And as we all know, if you're not an atheist, then you do know that when God fries French fries, he does them in duck fat. For those who are religious out there.
I see.
Yeah, yes. I mean,
it's a requirement. It's a sacrament.
As a foodie, I know these things. Yeah, exactly. if cranberries were there, they weren't, I mean, you know, so cranberries really come on the American scene in 1912 when we have this enterprising lawyer, Marcus Uren, who figures out that cranberries could be a market, and he goes on to found Ocean Spray. But it's not until 1941 that we get literally as it was marketed, the log of jellied cranberries that we still, I mean, if we don't have it on the table with the rounds, cranberries aren't on the table. This took a little bit of research, but I adore this fact that annually, every year, Americans eat just north of 5 million gallons of those logs of cranberries, or at least display on their Thanksgiving table.
Yeah. I make my own cranberry sauce. Thank you very much, from Whole Cranberries.
Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a New England tradition, too. I mean, yes, there were logs. I can remember going to a friend friends were combining, you know, my parents and other people, and it was a big dinner. Mm-hmm. There would be the log of cranberry, which I would never touch because it just, to me, looked disgusting.
Yeah.
But I love, because I love tart foods, and I love fresh cranberry cooked down into a very thick when the berries burst.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so this goes to the core of what I adore about Thanksgiving is that, you know, be truthful. On any other day of the year, do you bother making fresh cranberry sauce?
Probably not.
No, and none of us do. Would go through all of the steps and the machinations that it takes for a great Thanksgiving meal. Last but not least, sweet potatoes. The sweet potato did not exist. The sweet potato existed in the Americas. It came from the Caribbean. It did make its way over to Europe. In England at the time when the Puritans were sitting or standing, however they ate this first Thanksgiving meal, there were English that were eating a variety of the sweet potato, but it was considered a delicacy and it was eaten for its aphrodisiac. supposed aphrodisiac properties. Pretty sure the Puritans
were not doing that,
even if they had one. Which,
Well, and here's my what I'm thinking about. It makes me laugh. It's like, okay, it's supposed to be aphrodisiac. After you eat all that food, Most people are sleeping.
Yeah.
You want a nap.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of counterproductive.
So the thing that I like to take away and I want to impart to the listeners is with Thanksgiving is that it's really the result of this massive ecological experiment that happened, the Columbian Exchange, which is not a, you know, some subterfuge with a Mesoamerican drug dealer. It's when Columbus came over and that sort of thing. This planet had never seen anything as dramatic. Well, really, since Pangaea, 175 million years ago, started to separate. So when all the foodstuffs and the ecological changes started happening, really, in about 105 years, the world and its ecology from Europe to North and South America were turned upside down. And when we sit down for Thanksgiving, we're experiencing the results of that across this incredibly yummy meal that's very, very American. But we're living that experience of these, you know, really just a handful of explorers coming across and bringing, of course, smallpox and things like that. But the pig had never existed in the Caribbean, for instance, and you can't think of Cuban food without the pig. Potatoes and the Irish, you can't, I mean, it's a cultural identity, but they were only growing in the Andean
in Peru,
mountains.
I
yeah,
guess,
exactly.
Yeah.
And we could go on and on and on and on like this. So the turkey, like you said, you know, making full circle, but it was actually there. So they could have had it. It's just it wasn't considered a main foodstuff by the Native Americans. Venison and all of the seafood was much more delicious and accessible. So why work that hard?
I was going to say, so if we wanted to add to our Thanksgiving feast, mm-hmm. if we wanted to go beyond turkey and stuffing and all of that, you could add lobster.
You could.
And you could add mussels and oysters, all things I love, mm-hmm. because I grew up in New England. Mm-hmm. I am not a big venison fan. It depends on how ripe it is.
You need to eat the venison that is harvested, hunted from the northern part of the state. As
okay.
an old sage hunter told me once, because sage grows so wild up there that it's already pre-seasoned. And
okay.
I didn't believe him until I had it, and I thought, you know, there's something to this.
There's something to this.
Yeah.
And, of course, sage is a big part of
sure.
stuffing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Or at least my stuffing.
Yeah.
So, well, Kyle Cherik, now I'm hungry, and I have to wait until tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
To that's, eat all yeah. of this. But
I'm going home to prep. I'm going to
yeah,
dive
me
right
too.
Into it. It's already started, yep. and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, happy cooking and happy eating and happy feasting to you and your family. And we'll catch up next month when we talk about Christmas.
Christmas. Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. He is not planning to have venison or lobster for his Thanksgiving meal. Well, at least not this year. Coming up, as you prepare to sit down for your Thanksgiving meal, some of you may be concerned about acid reflux or heartburn. Well, if so, this next conversation is for you. So stick around. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanksgiving can be a recipe for heartburn and acid reflux. Fatty foods, alcohol, and overeating are the hallmarks of the holiday, and any of those can trigger an attack. And for those of us with gastroesophageal reflux disease, which is also known as GERD, avoiding these things can feel isolating, like you're not truly able to celebrate. But as Dr. John Gould will tell you, you're not alone. Dr. Gould is the chief of the Division of General Surgery, and he's the vice chair of surgical quality at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the disease and how to keep it in check.
Well, GERD is a really common condition, first of all. About 1 out of 10 American adults suffers from symptoms. The most common symptom is heartburn, typically a burning sensation behind the breastbone brought on by eating spicy foods for a lot of folks. Some people can actually taste sour material that almost tastes like it once was in their stomach, which it was. There's a variety of other symptoms that people can suffer from, but those are the two most common.
Well, and what distinguishes it from your garden variety acid reflux? Because I think most of us have had like a moment or two where we get a little bit of that, but GERD seems to be distinctly different.
Right. Now, that's a great question. So gastroesophageal reflux is what you just described, and that's a distinct entity from the disease, which is pathologic acid reflux. So everybody has heartburn every now and then. It's just a part of life. We all get it. It's when it happens frequently to the point where it impacts your quality of life, where you develop esophageal damage actually from harmful reflux, that it becomes a disease process. And so that's the distinction, but it is exceedingly common to escalate from just, you know, run-of-the-mill heartburn every now and then to a bigger problem.
What are the issues that it can cause for you in kind of your everyday life?
Well, there's great statistics that show that people that suffer from reflux tend to be less productive at work. They are bothered by symptoms to the degree where their quality of life is impaired and it's just not enjoyable. It's one of those things that's so common that people kind of blow it off to a certain extent. But when you're suffering from it and there's no getting away from it, it really does kind of become an all-consuming issue for people. You know, lost work, productivity, all kinds of problems that come from this, lots of medical care that's needed. So it really can kind of escalate and spiral once it gets out of control.
If this is something that you're dealing with kind of on a regular basis, how would you go about getting diagnosed? How do you know when it's GERD?
Sure. What happens in reality is a lot of people are either diagnosed with it by their primary care doctor, or they might even self-diagnose. Nowadays, a lot of acid suppression medications are available over the counter. So many people will just self-medicate and they'll feel better and they'll just kind of run with that. If it's a more serious problem than that, there's a variety of testing that can be done to prove the diagnosis. One of the most common first tests that will be done is an upper endoscopy, where they'll actually stick a thin fiber optic scope into a patient's esophagus and take a look at and see if there's any damage. And there's many other tests beyond that, but that's kind of the first step for most folks.
Well, and, you know, as you've mentioned, GERD is generally just this kind of minor annoyance to some, something that is detrimental to their quality of life, but also something that can be controlled with over-the-counter drugs. But then there are those who have very severe cases of GERD.
Right.
What happens when it's really bad?
Yeah. So people that have it real bad can actually, they can have terrible esophagitis, which can lead to swallowing problems. In fact, people can have such severe damage to their esophagus that they can develop a condition known as Barrett's esophagus, which is actually a precancerous condition. Esophageal adenocarcinoma is linked to long-term chronic gastroesophageal reflux disease. So that's kind of a worst-case scenario. All kinds of terrible things can happen, you know, in folks that have really struggled with it for a long time.
How does it end up becoming cancerous? What about GERD leads to cancer?
That's a great question, and we don't know the exact answer to that. But basically, the reflux damages the lining of the esophagus, and the repeated process of being damaged and healing again and being damaged and healing again. GERD is a chronic condition. It doesn't go away in people that have it severely. Kind of that process leads the cells to undergo a process known as neoplasia or dysplasia, where the cells start to change into this precancerous lesion, which, again, in some folks can progress. So it's the chronicity and the severity of the disease that in some folks can lead to this.
So when we're talking about some of the advanced cases of GERD, we are looking at a situation where people would be getting surgery. What does that look like? What does that mean?
Yeah, so the fundamental problem in reflux is not that you make too much acid. It's that the valve at the end of your esophagus is no longer functioning appropriately. That's the basic construct. Basically, where surgery differs from medical therapy is that the goal of surgery is to reconstruct that valve. So medical therapy doesn't stop reflux from happening. It makes what you reflux have less acid in it. So it tends to help with the burning and things like that. But there's a point where when you're refluxing a lot, it's miserable regardless of the acid content. And so the goal of surgery is to rebuild that valve in a way where you no longer reflux at all. And there's a variety of different approaches. Most of them are minimally invasive, whether it's with a laparoscope through small incisions or sometimes even with an endoscope without incisions. But the goal of all of those interventions is to tighten that valve and stop reflux.
So there are plenty of basic lifestyle choices, habits that can contribute to GERD. One of them, as you mentioned earlier, is food. What are some of the foods that can cause this problem?
So anything that irritates an already irritated esophagus can do it. So typically acidic foods. If you're already suffering from reflux in your esophagus, the lining of it is irritated. You know, tomato sauce, orange juice, things like that can irritate the esophagus. Then there's another category of foods that lead to reflux, which can actually lead a weak lower esophageal sphincter to relax. And those are things like alcohol and things like that. And that can make GERD worse as well.
What are some of the other habits that if you're someone who their GERD is really acting up again, like might not be really controlled by those over-the-counter drugs as well as it could be, what are some of the other habits that you should maybe think about stopping?
Yeah, so I think when you're seriously suffering, there's a variety of steps that each person should take. Losing a little weight, if you have some weight to lose, is a great start. Being careful about what you eat. If there are specific foods that lead you to have heartburn, then avoiding those is a great idea. Not eating late at night, so you don't want a full stomach when you lay down because that can predispose you to having reflux over the night. Nighttime, not laying down immediately after you eat for the same reason. Stop smoking, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of lifestyle modifications that people should take on before they go down the path of escalating beyond medications to some of the surgical procedures that we do for reflux.
Well, Dr. John Gould, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You bet. Thank you.
Dr. John Gould is the chief of the Division of General Surgery and the vice chair of surgical quality at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find more of our conversations about health and wellness at WUWM.com. A big meal like Thanksgiving can leave us with a refrigerator full of leftovers. And for some folks, the leftovers are the best part, well, as long as you don't leave them sit for too long. Lake Effect SAS Joanne Nelson has been thinking about what the contents of our refrigerators say about us to others.
Leftovers. Mayonnaise, cream cheese, sun-dried tomatoes, Thai peanut sauce. My visiting, hungry daughter checks expiration dates and exhales patients. One hand holds the refrigerator door open, and she bends at the waist to reach for each jar, long hair falling over her shoulder. From my seat at the kitchen counter, I analyze each item ahead of her hand, calculating length of time since purchase. This is how it begins. Soon the phrase, "And you should see what I found in her refrigerator," will pepper her conversation with friends. My mother's refrigerator, at the end of her independence, contained, among other things, a saucepan of chicken noodle soup, small moons of chicken fat floating in the thin broth, plastic containers of gray-brown fuzziness, and several half cans of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. I tossed and tossed into white hefty bags, which I stacked next to the overfull garbage bin at the end of her driveway. No one witnessed the hunched muscles of my shoulders or the building tension in my face as I worked. But if my mother could escape her nursing home, could escape her failing self, I think she'd recognize this look, even be able to imitate it. I wore it so often in her presence. The handle of my grandmother's Philco was a hard pull before the loud, sticky door seal released to reveal half-eaten apple pie, gravy-soaked roast beef on a chip flour-rimmed plate, and drying, unwrapped cheese on yet another chip plate. Every Sunday, her small home filled with luscious smells and flavors, savory pies and meats. I ate and overate, but avoided any leftovers if I visited during the week. All those exposed leftovers growing more harmful with each passing day. Perhaps I was too cautious, though. Grandma cooked for herself well into her 90s. She lived until my daughter grew in me, until I could reach into the refrigerator of my own home and bring out apples extra flavorful for having been kept cold and unsliced. I remember the comforting edge of those broken plates, can see the dividing line where the border of the aging yellow-orange cheese faded to softness, where a thin paring knife could cut away anything unpleasant and save the rest for another time. I hear her say, "Whatever I do to my mother, I'll get back threefold." I hear her say it again as I watch my girl, now so grown, so beautiful, turn from the refrigerator, jar in hand, like a punctuation mark of continuance or ending.
Lake Effect essayist Joanne Nelson is a psychotherapist in Heartland and the author of the forthcoming memoir, This Is How We Leave. We will take one last break, and then our Fit for You series explores muscle activation technique. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
Turn this leg in again. Now we're going to retest. Okay. So we're going to go back into that position again. Bring the leg out again and then relax there. Don't let me push you in. Ready? Hold. There we go. So see how you can fire it better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's very subtle.
That's Emily Yenner working on Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski with a method called Muscle Activation Technique, or MAT. Yenner has been a physical therapist for the past 20 years, and for the first 10 of those, she'd used the traditional methods like ultrasound, deep tissue stretching, and others to release muscle tightness in her clients. But she felt frustrated that most of the techniques were not getting to the root of the issues that clients were having with their movement. Yenner became Wisconsin's first female MAT-certified specialist in 2010, and she hasn't looked back. For this month's Fit for You, Audrey Nowakowski went to see Yenner to find out more.
Emily Yenner, welcome to Lake Effect Remote from your office. Thanks for having me in today.
Thank you for coming in. It's great to have you here.
So we're here talking about muscle activation technique, or MAT, but before we get into the intricacies of this, what is the main function of our muscles? We don't think of them too much outside of they're here. Sometimes they hurt. We use them to move every day. So what's the nitty-gritty of the muscles?
Sure. So I always tell my clients there's three main functions that our muscles serve. They help to align our skeleton, they help to move us from place to place, and then they also serve as a pump for our lymphatic fluid.
With muscles aligning our skeleton, creating movement, stopping and controlling movement, what is muscle tightness often a symptom of?
Sure. Muscle tightness is usually a sign that there is a muscular weakness someplace in the body. So a lot of people are so focused on the tightness, but they don't feel that there's actually a weakness at the root of that. So many traditional therapies are working toward reducing tightness with either stretching or soft tissue massage or deep tissue massage, or rolling on balls and foam rollers and all sorts of things to loosen the tightness. But usually the weakness that's underlying the tightness is really the problem, not the tightness itself.
And is the weakness in the muscle that's tight, or are we kind of viewing that differently too?
That's a great question. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's someplace else in the system, not even close to where your muscle is tight. So if your muscle is tight in your hamstring, it might be that some of your core muscles are actually weak, and then your body is trying to stabilize itself and uses that tight hamstring to stabilize you and hold you up or help you move in a way that your core is not functioning properly to do so itself.
So in the past, what are the traditional treatments for muscular imbalances?
Sure. So I've been a physical therapist for 20 years, and the first 10 years before I was introduced to MAT, I would locate tightness in the muscular system from head to toe, wherever, or usually when my clients were coming to see me, it was for one part at a time. So I would find tightness, I would dig around on it with my thumbs and elbows and anything I could to try to release the tightness. Sometimes I would use ultrasound or electrical stimulation to calm things down, get circulation flowing. I would often teach stretches and ways to elongate those areas of tightness to release it. And then I would do some general strengthening for core posture, depending on what part of the body was affected, but never really address the weakness right away. in the treatments. So that's what I did as a traditional therapist.
And obviously, I mean, I don't want to say it's simplistic because our bodies are not simple, but do you think the way of treating with physical therapy and, you know, we always think we need to stretch our muscles, we need to roll and release them. Is that too much of a large brush to paint over what's happening with our bodies?
Well, I think as time goes on and more techniques are explored to help people feel better and move better, we sometimes get stuck in old ways of thinking. And so as our thought processes evolve over time and as working with the body, as so many people are doing, and they're doing research and development to figure out what is the best way to affect positive change in the body, we're realizing that stretching might not be as wonderful as we once thought that it was, or that digging on a tight muscle to release it only really gives us short-term relief. So I think, again, just as our understanding of how the body works and what treatments work effectively for the body evolves, so too are our thought processes on what else are we trying to do to make the system more efficient.
So that leads perfectly into what we're here to talk about today, Matt. So what is it? How did this technique come about? And how did you come into now practicing it as a background as a physical therapist?
Sure. So MAT is muscle activation techniques, and it was it's a biomechanical, very systematic process that is designed to identify and then also treat muscular weakness at the root of injuries, impeded performance, and compromised healing. So it was developed by a gentleman named Greg Roscoff, who is now the Denver Broncos biomechanics consultant. So he was working with a lot of professional athletes trying to get them back on the court and back on the field, and so was introduced to muscle testing through his training, and was really figuring out how to best help these athletes get on the field and court as quickly as he could. And he was having such great results that people in the rehab community were asking, what are you using? What are you doing? Can we learn this too? So he developed a training program, and that also has evolved quite a bit over the last 20 years or so that it's been implemented. So I had been a physical therapist for about 10 years, and I was frustrated by the lack of progress that I felt like I was making with my clients. I felt like the treating the tightness, digging in on these tight muscles, trying to stretch these tight muscles, it really wasn't getting to the root of things. So when I heard about MAT from some friends that were there, that were studying it, I thought, this is what I thought I was supposed to learn in physical therapy school and never did. And Marquette was a wonderful school. It was a great foundation, but we just don't have the time or the know-how to go into the specifics like they do with MAT. So I was just almost hooked immediately with the concept and the ease of the techniques. And so got certified in 2010 and never looked back.
Now, it seems to be not very common here yet, though,
Correct. Right, correct. So yeah, I was the second physical therapist who got certified. There are still a handful of the original MAT crew here in town, but now I'm the only physical therapist that's practicing this, I believe, in Wisconsin. And there are some other females now, but I was the first female, so that's kind of exciting. But yeah, the community is growing, which is great. I think the more people we can help educate about this process even being available, and even being available to learn for a profession, I think it's great that the word is getting out. So, but it is still a relatively small community.
And is it a requirement that you already need to be a PT professional?
No, not at all. In fact, most of the practitioners come from an exercise background, so they're either personal trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, exercise physiologists. There was a gentleman in my internship who was approaching retirement, and he had been in car sales and was looking to do something totally different. So you don't have to have a background in medical field or wellness field. I think it is easier for those of us who've already been introduced to the muscular system and the anatomy and the inner workings of the body, but it is not a requirement to have a medical background.
So with our muscles, we can see versus diagrams that we've learned in school, our connections to our skeleton and things. But how does muscular imbalance affect our joints? And do you find that joints are often an afterthought because we're focused on the physical pain of our muscles being sore or tight?
Sure. So our joints are basically just interspaces between bones. And our bones are from a physics standpoint, they're basically serving as levers for our muscles to attach to and move us through the world. So when a muscle is firing appropriately, the pressures and the motions happening at a joint are most efficient. When muscles start to break down, there could be different pressures at the joint when you start, and then it starts to lead to bone-on-bone movement. We have all sorts of different sensory receptors in our body, though. So sometimes the feeling of having a muscle tight versus the feeling of a joint receptor being aware of some sort of icky position or forces at the actual joint itself, those kind of sensations are maybe a little bit different. So I think a lot of us do have an awareness of what our muscles feel like when they're achy, especially if you work out, you'll have that after workout soreness. But a joint dysfunction and a joint pain usually is a little sharper and it's a little more uncomfortable and limiting of our motions. However, it's the muscles that are at the root of the joint even being able to move in the first place. So I don't know if that fully answers the question, but okay. Yeah.
And another component of MAT that I feel isn't covered as much in physical therapy, unless you're using electric therapy, ultrasound, things like that. But the communication between the nervous system and the muscle pain, and as you were walking me through some of the exercises, just the extra brain power it took to control and move those smaller muscles. So how does that play into everything here?
Sure. So it's kind of funny because here in my office, I have some different charts. I have the skeletal system listed. I have the nervous system. I have the muscular system, but we're all one system. We compartmentalize things for learning purposes. But basically, to keep it simple here, the brain communicates with our entire body through the nervous system. The signals are sent down into our spinal cord, into our nerves, and then into the muscle fibers. And then if you want to move from place to place, your brain tells your muscles to contract in a very orchestrated, specific way so that you can move efficiently and gracefully and you're not flailing all over the place. So our nervous system is at the, it's almost like a computer. And so your computer programs are set up even, you know, and you develop them and they get more ingrained as you grow and develop. So our nervous system is always at the root of muscle function. So we can tap into that nervous system and kind of reboot it, if you will, with certain hands-on techniques and exercise positions and activities to help the body relearn how to move. So it really is a great way, MAT is a great way to build that brain and body connection.
Now, you came upon MAT as an additional education for your personal practice in physical therapy, but I understand you also needed it at one point in your life. So how did that, as a practitioner and then needing treatment and finding this new technique, how did that change things for you?
Well, it was a total life changer for sure. So I had already started studying MAT and then was taking the internship, but it was early on in the internship, and then I was involved in a rollover car accident exactly 10 years ago, actually. But so when I went through physical therapy, this was the first time in my life I had ever had to go through physical therapy, and I had already been a PT myself for 10 years. The gentleman who I saw was the first physical therapist in Wisconsin to become certified with MAT, and he took me through 12 sessions of MAT, you know, as a physical therapy modality. And within I had some neck and shoulder issues, and so within the 12 sessions that I had seen him, I felt even better than I had prior to the accident. So it was just a great confirmation that this is what I'm supposed to be doing to help other people. It was a really beautiful way to overcome my injuries. And then also now I know what it's like to be on the other side of the pain and dysfunction and then see it through with this particular modality. So I am a little biased, but but it worked for me amazingly. And I've seen it work for a lot of people much better, I have to say, than some of the traditional PT techniques that I had used prior to that. So it was a lifesaver for me, and it was a total career changer for me as well.
So are you focusing strictly on MAT versus PT now?
Yes, I pretty much do. Once you learn MAT, it's hard to go back to some of the traditional methods that I had been employing. So it's, okay.
Yeah. So one thing that is often a problem just in treating our own bodies, but we wait for things to hurt before things happen, or we need a doctor's note to get physical therapy, even though I feel like these kinds of things would be helpful for anybody at any point in their life. So this gap between the medical and exercise fields and wellness, you know, how can we shorten it? And would you like to see this kind of therapy become just a general practice for people to keep people moving well? And, you know, not necessarily preventative treatment, but it's that versus a reactive process.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of the work that I do is in educating my clients to understand that this is a process. I wish that I had the end-all be-all. I wish I could say that MAT was the end-all be-all when it comes to healing every single ailment. Our bodies are very complex, but when you have a muscle specialist and someone who gets to know the inner workings of your body from head to toe, it's so much easier when something does flare up, or if you do get a new issue, someone that already knows your body can then intervene and have a positive impact, as opposed to waiting until you're broken down. I mean, I'll see it both ways. You know, as a PT, a lot of people come to see me because they're in pain, because they've injured themselves. But my goal is to really help educate them that this can be a process that you can use to just keep yourself functioning well. But you're right. A lot of times we do wait until something is in crisis mode to actually get, well, here's the deal. We're all so busy that we wait until something is slapping us across the face to try to get our attention. Yes. That something needs to be dealt with now. So I choose to stay out of network with insurance. I know it's hard for some people to invest in their wellness and their preventative care, but because we don't have someone sitting behind a desk dictating how many sessions I get to see someone for or what body part I can work on, we get to choose how often we see each other as client and practitioner. And that is a very helpful part of this process too. I see people who have some acute issues going on, but then I also see people just on a regular basis. They'll come in every month or every couple of months just to kind of reboot their system. And I will say, I've never had a session where I didn't find something that I could enhance the function of when my clients are here.
With PT, often we're assigned a body part, an ailment. This is what we're being treated for. So with MAT, I feel like maybe it's a bigger approach than that. Like you said, everything's interconnected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And because it is such a systematic approach, we're able to tap into asking the body, kind of, for lack of a better way of saying it, ask the body where its priority is for treatment. So through range of motion testing, through muscle testing, we can really determine where is the best place to intervene and try to enhance the function of the muscular system. And in the traditional PT setting, I was sort of limited with how much of the body I could actually address and look at. Whereas with MAT, you're treated as a whole person. You're treated as a whole Audrey. I'm not just going to treat you part by part. Because it is a pretty systematic approach, we do kind of work on maybe one part at a time, but it's still with the whole system in mind.
Emily Yenner is a muscle activation technique certified specialist, and she is also a physical therapist. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited her at 1212 Body Works out in Brookfield for this month's Fit for You segment. You can find out more about Matt and explore past fitness segments at WUWM.com. We have time for some music to finish our show today. Here is Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour, recorded in our performance studio back in September. It's an original tune called These Moments.
Thank you.
Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour performing his own composition, These Moments. It was recorded in our studio back in September by audio engineer Jason Reavy. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North, wishing you and yours a very happy Thanksgiving. Becky Mortensen, Joy Powers, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy our audio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Lake Effect is taking a break for Thanksgiving and the day after, so please join us again on Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. As always, you will hear us on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock now, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.